Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Main Street Universe. This next song is written by a friend of ours, Meg Barnhouse. Welcome to Main Street Universe. The first thing I would like to do is welcome my co-host while I put my guitar away, the amazing Mr. Kevin Bear, all the way from the Temple of Gaia.
Hello, hello. Another beautiful day in the neighborhood. I'm just saying it's a great day in the morning out there. Could be afternoon for our guys who are overseas. Veronica in the chat room, along with our other friends that are out there. Brett, Marcy, Melissa, Reverend Phoenix Firestar.
All right.
How are y'all doing?
Yes, how is everyone doing? And I'd like to start off by introducing our Eye in the Sky, if he's out there and with us, Mr. Brett Rune Hillman. Are you there, Brett?
Hang on just a second. Let's see. Let me find him out there.
And today we will be discussing a few different things. We'll be discussing some charities and nonprofits, as well as the nature of reality itself. Are you there, Brett?
I am indeed here.
Ah, there you are. And we as well have a fourth member to our Main Street Universe family now. As they say in Taoism, a lot of people don't know that they have an exorcism in Taoism, and when they exercise in their technique is to get rid of excess yin or female energy, but we don't want to get rid of our female energy on this show. We still like having her around, and that is Melissa DeGenova. Are you there, Melissa?
I am indeed, and I hope it balanced things out just a little bit.
Hi, Melissa.
Good morning, everybody.
And this morning we are joined by a special guest, Unitarian Universalist, minister of Accotink Church in Burke, Virginia. He's here to discuss some charity and nonprofit groups, and it is the Reverend Scott Samwer Michael. And there's his symbol.
It's great to be here in Cafe Fairfax with you all.
And Scott, what is one of the first groups you want to discuss? Maybe facets?
Well, yeah, we can talk about a handful of things. One of the interesting things in the spiritual life is remaining connected to what's happening in the real world around us. And that's probably easier for me, serving a religious community that has brick and mortar like Accotink Church. Other people have different paths. What I'm able to do with the very devoted and generous people at Accotink Church is I'm able to be engaged with a handful of charities. One of them that we did this year was to use our sanctuary as a hypothermia shelter. Fairfax County, Virginia is really one of the few places in America that has the tax base and the political will both combined to do a lot of services for homeless people. They started a group, they started an initiative a couple years ago that was an effort to end homelessness in Fairfax. And sometimes the most difficult thing in this county is telling people that there is a homelessness problem in Fairfax County, Virginia, because Fairfax County is one of the more affluent and better educated counties in America. But what they realized they wanted to do, especially in a state like Virginia that is very fiscally conservative and conscious of spending, they created a nonprofit group called Facets. And what Facets does is it acts as a networking group with all the different nonprofit providers like churches and food and soup kitchens and shelters, and coordinates government services all in one package. So when our church decided to be a hypothermia shelter, we got training from Facets. They told us what kind of insurance we needed. We were able to make sure that our place would pass fire code for being a shelter. They helped us get through that. They actually provide the vans where we pick people up for the homeless shelter. We actually go and pick them up at a local metro stop, a subway stop.
Okay.
And so it's pretty amazing when you get a church that has 190 members and you have 100 of them in a single week all involved in one social justice project, mm-hmm. like providing shelter for those who are homeless in our county in this hypothermia project. It really gave us a deepened sense of why we're a church, but it also helped us learn how we can come together in this focused way, provide a major program that's needed for the county. And, of course, the backside of that is you learn so much more about yourself and about, you know, the church by sort of working together in service. I mean, you can think about it all you want, and you can sing the hymns and have fun and feel connected, but it's different when you're actually sort of getting down and dirty, as it were, and doing work.
Mm-hmm. And another group I remember you mentioning was Our Daily Bread.
Our Daily Bread is another one of those great nonprofits here. It's based in Fairfax City, right next to Buffalo Wing University up in the Courthouse Plaza.
Oh, I've seen that.
Between University and Old Lee Highway, just north of North Street. Our Daily Bread is another one of these groups that has emerged in Fairfax County as we realize that despite most of the affluence, there's still thousands of people who don't have enough food. And so they have been around and been effective for so long that people actually give them almost too much food at times because they don't have a place to store it. So they look to churches and other nonprofits to help identify people who are hungry and help get the food to them. So Our Daily Bread has an executive directorship, and they do have some employees. They have a handful of locations around the county, and what they do is they get stuff from restaurants, from grocery stores, and they're able to take that stuff and turn it around into all kinds of good stuff. And one of the interesting things is they actually help kids. They'll actually will help kids who are hungry. They'll stuff their backpack at school so they can take food home for their families. And the reason that that's kind of important is a lot of times people are afraid to admit that they need help. And so it's really nice to see that they have been able to find a way to gently give people the help they need. So they sort of call them into the cafeteria towards the end of the day and give them a bunch of stuff to put in their backpacks to take home to their families. It's a pretty amazing group.
Cool. Anyway, I was just saying sometimes it breaks up back there.
I'm sorry.
It's quite all right.
For those who are listening in the comfort of your pajamas, I'm behind my drum set here in the Cafe Fairfax studio, and I've been told there may be a little signal issue, so I'm walking about. Imagine that, me walking around while talking. I can't imagine that happening.
I do it all the time. I do the show standing up. I'm not even in front of the computer.
Well, I have a question.
Sure, go ahead. Good, because... I'll take that one.
We're sharing microphones here. Reverend Scott, you talk about getting the food to the people so it can go into their backpacks, and then they go to your Daily Bread and everything, and they take that food that they have home, but you were saying how they're also homeless is the same, you know, in the same way or whatever. If they're homeless, where are they that they take this food to?
That's a really good question. The shelters are the first place they take them. There are a handful of homeless shelters around Fairfax County, from Eleanor Kennedy down by Fort Belvoir. There's one out in Herndon, and there's a couple around here. The hypothermia shelter project is only up and running during the winter months, hence its name. We don't provide a year-round shelter services. So it's interesting how resourceful and knowledgeable most homeless people are. When we were serving as the shelter, I mean, they knew where we were. So those, when they missed the van, they found a way to get to us. They know where the pickup parts are. Now, the interesting thing is, you know, that's for the folks who are chronically homeless or sort of habitually homeless, cyclically homeless. Sometimes the people who are newly homeless are the ones that are most difficult to reach because they're embarrassed, they're scared, they've never been homeless before, they don't want to tell people that they need help. Sometimes the hardest thing convincing someone, you know, to do is to ask for help, because in a community like this, we actually have a lot of help, unlike some places. And just the county south of us, Prince William, has virtually no shelters, no help like this that we have up here. So it changes quickly, and so, you know, I just encourage any of you anywhere listening, when you're driving around, just look at open patches of woods. There's probably somebody living in them.
Islands on the highways.
I mean, there was a handful of people living in these woods by exit ramps down on 95 by Dale City, which is just south of Fairfax, and they actually chased them out of those woods because a couple of them got hit crossing the exit ramp. So they made a move to woods further down away because, you know, you can't tell somebody they have to go to a shelter. You can't, you know, so a lot of people don't look for shelters. They want to be independent,
even if
they're homeless. And so it's a very difficult issue, but it's nice to see the citizens of this county understand that they're blessed and wanting to try and do something for those who may not share those same blessings.
And if you remember, this is my conversation flag here. If you remember, when we lived in Havre de Grace, Maryland, there was definitely people living in our woods behind our house. There, remember, it would snow, and we would see all kinds of footprints in the snow the next day, and it would be a brand new snow, right?
Yep.
And all of a sudden, the very next morning, there was all kinds of footprints, even dog prints, like maybe one of them had a dog, right? Like little tracks.
Yeah, Dan and I were kind of the landed gentry in a really old farmhouse out there on this big hill. There were people living behind us. And there were people hunting back there, too, I remember. Remember if you remember that.
And
it's an interesting place.
One statistic I remember that a lot of people might not know is that I believe the number was, is it 60 or 70% of homeless people have a job, or is it even more than that?
In Fairfax County, it's upwards of 60% of the homeless are working. 30% of them are homeless because they're victims of domestic violence.
Mm.
The number one crime problem in Fairfax County is domestic violence.
Mm.
We have a relatively crime-free county, and every time I speak to the officials here, they remind me that that is our number one crime problem, and that's a very difficult one to get people to talk about.
Yeah, definitely. And Kevin?
If we get the economy repaired, and if you notice, the title of our show today is Economy Matrix 2.0, Service Pack 20. Once we get the, we move on to like Economy 3.0, and things start picking up or being a little more productive, prosperous.
Mm.
Will these people who are homeless, or you say psychically homeless, would they find a way to put a roof over their head, or would they stay in the zone that they're in?
Mm. The interesting answer to that question is that there's always going to be homeless people, because people get homeless because of strange situations that happen in their lives. Yes, there are some people who are what folks like to call economically incompetent, right? They don't know how to handle money. They get themselves into situations. There are people who may be what's called dual diagnosis, which means they may have mental illness or drug addiction or both. But the truth is, there are people with drug addiction and mental illness who aren't homeless. You know, I mean, I know plenty of them. those folks, there's always going to be gaps in the system. You can't create a fail-safe system. And that's why this partnership with Facets and Our Daily Bread and the Fairfax County government is particularly important, because it's the churches, it's the other nonprofits that see these folks before the county ever does. Because a lot of folks are reluctant to go to the government for whatever reason. I mean, imagine if someone has, you know, a trend towards alcoholism, well, you know, or drug addiction. Well, they're not going to go to the police department to ask for help, right? They're used to running away from the police, right?
Right.
So it's nice to live in a community that looks at that first. So the economic piece of this, one of the problems we have here in Fairfax County and in many parts of the country is a lack of affordable housing for low-income people. The average rent in this county is around $2,000 a month for a regular small size apartment.
That's a lot.
That's a lot of
for
money. That's $24,000 a year.
And for a southern state, to think of
that. We are the People's Republic of Northern Virginia. We're not quite the South, but we are blessed with all of the economy that the federal government and those agencies bring here too.
Do you
right?
think a job at McDonald's would pay for that?
No,
minimum wage jobs do not help you to get into places. You have to be making more than poverty to afford to live in most places in Northern Virginia. That's not true in all communities here, but most places in Northern Virginia. And so what we've tried to do, and I can transition this to talk about another group I work with, you have to have hands-on direct services for people who are in need, you know, food and shelter. However, you also have to be addressing the system that makes that need, you know, present in the first place, and that's a public policy issue. So one of the groups that I'm actually a strategy team member of is called VOICE, Virginians Organized for Interfaith Community Engagement.
Mm-hmm.
And VOICE is what's called a power organization, part of the Industrial Areas Foundation. Saul Alinsky's group founded in the 1930s in the poor parts of Chicago. And the interesting thing about Voice is it is a coalition of Muslims and Jews and Catholics and Lutherans and Unitarian Universalists and pagans and Hindus, a broad-based coalition. And what we come together on is work on issues that we can all agree on. Mm-hmm. So, for instance, you know, I could never get Voice to work for, say, gay marriage because a lot of those religious groups don't support gay marriage. But what we do work on is economic distress. We work on affordable housing. And one of the big fights that we're working on right now is relief to people who are the victims of predatory lending in the mortgage crisis. In Prince William County alone, there are 1,600 families who have been displaced because of predatory lending, and that's the minimum figure just over the last couple of years. They were mostly non-white and non-English-speaking people who were targeted by the likes of Bank of America and Countrywide Mortgage and GE Mortgage, and they were targeted and promised the world. I mean, I'm not going to go over the whole economic crisis meltdown, but basically what happened was people were told that they could afford a house that they could never afford. Yeah. They were told they could afford this house, and they would be given a realtor that spoke their language, like Spanish or Vietnamese, but when it came time to sit down to the settlement for the house, all the documents would be in English. There'd be no translator, and they were just said, "Here's the number you have to tell me that you make in order to afford this house," and the realtors and the brokers would leave the room, and they would sign it because they're like, "Why would somebody give me money if they don't think I can pay them back?"
Right.
So our big fight right now, we actually have a meeting with Jeffrey Immelt from GE Mortgage, the CEO of GE Mortgage, next Monday, and we're looking to sort of say, "You created this mess, and we're looking for a $300 to $500 million reinvestment plan over the next 10 years to alleviate the crisis that they caused." I mean, they made billions out of Virginia, and so it's So that Voice is a great example of how people who otherwise don't see eye to eye on a lot of things from different religious traditions can come together and work on things that we can agree on.
You know, right.
Affordable housing. We're working on immigration reform, and we're working on this foreclosure crisis. And it's great to be working with people that, well, many other issues, I would be on the other side of their issue, right? But it's nice that we can work together, and it's a great gift.
All right. Yeah, and is there, say, on your Acatink Unitarian site, does it have links to any of these?
There should be links to Voice. I don't think we have links to Facets or our Daily Bread, though.
Okay.
If you do searches, they're easy to find.
Google them up, then.
Google them up, and they're easy to find, and that's a good poke for me to make sure our web team gets those links put up on there. I haven't followed through on that.
That's fine. And let's speak about something that you helped form or birth, and that's the Tool Belt Ministry.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing. When I went to seminary, I was working as an industrial electrician, as you know, Dan, because you're an electrician too.
Yes.
And I was thinking I'd have to leave all that behind me, and I went to seminary thinking that, you know, I was beginning this completely new life. I was going to have a new me by the time I became a minister and, you know, had the UUA stamp on the back of my neck, as it were. And in the end, what happened was I realized that there were ways for me to use all my gifts, you know, as serving as a minister. And so I always was in love with New Orleans, and I used to go to Jazz Fest every year before I went to seminary. I actually haven't been to Jazz Fest since I went to seminary. And when my wife is minister of our church in Sterling, Reverend Anya Sambler Michael, when we met in seminary, we were like, wow, we think we like each other, but we're not sure. We're in this really small school in this really cold city. So I said, why don't we go to New Orleans? So we went to New Orleans, and we realized that, maybe we were meant to be together, and that's, and so that was New Year's Eve of 2005. Well, in late August of 2005 was when Hurricane Katrina hit, and then Hurricane Rita hit about 3 weeks later.
Hmm.
And I was just so devastated, and I felt kind of helpless being stuck in grad school in Chicago, that when I met my internship supervisor, Sarah Lambert, she said, why don't we do something? Why don't you do something about this? You know how to build houses. So I thought about it and really talked to some great mentors, Rosemary Bray McNatt in New York and Reverend Bill Schultz, who used to be Amnesty International director and,
uh-huh.
and president of the UUA, who's now a faculty member at Meadville Lombard, where I was in seminary. And they encouraged me to start Tool Belt Ministries. And Tool Belt Ministries was meant to train people how to do relief trips, rebuilding trips to New Orleans. I did a couple first to see what it was like. And what I realized is people didn't know how to train the groups to do the work well, and how to create the expectations and prepare people. Because you go into a distressed house in the Lower Ninth Ward in New Orleans where someone's had their home washed away and you're trying to rebuild it, they've suffered a lot of trauma. And you need to prepare the volunteers going down there to know how to encounter somebody that's dealt with that trauma. Because you can be traumatized by other people's trauma. People who have been through all that and you see it and you witness it, it can really have an effect on your soul. And so we learned how to organize work teams. We learned how to train and recruit really good foremen and to lead those work teams. And we taught people how to, you know, to encourage a good means of service to go that was sort of in line with their religious values, but let them have realistic expectations. You're down there for a week. I mean, you're not going to finish their house.
No.
You know, so you have to understand what you can do, what you can expect, and how and what spirit you're supposed to be in relationship with the person who owns the house.
Okay. All right, and that sounds good.
So it was, I want to ask Kevin something, because he was talking about the economy.
Sure.
And it's interesting to me right now, we're going through a time that where we're trying to figure out how best to look at the next version of our economy.
Economy 3.0.
3.0, right.
Yeah.
You know, and if you look at Europe, which just happened last week with the elections, you know, the notion that it has to be all austerity or all stimulus, you know, it seems to be the two things, and maybe Europe's as polarized as the U.S. is right now.
Well, I want to know if that political system that everybody's protesting against, if that is a Betamax. Remember, we went from Betamax to VHS or whatever. So what if that governmental system is a Betamax process and system, and that it needs to be upgraded? It's an app. It's not exactly on your iPhone, but it affects your iPhone kind of stuff. It's an app that needs to be upgraded. How do we make that happen? Do we send patches in there? Do we do virus detection? Do we need, like, a new firewall or something to get that thing improved out there? Educate these people who are trying to run the system to make our lives better, which isn't working.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so what do we do?
Well, you know, we've had a lot of assumptions about the economy, you know, in the last 50 years in this country, and they keep changing, of course. And if you want to look at some of the basic understandings that the 20th century and early 21st century economy has been built on. The chief economist for that is John Maynard Keynes, and it's a pretty simple process. I mean, Keynes just basically says that when you have boom time, you pay off your debts, but when you have stress, economic distress or depression or recession, you need to invest, and that's how we operated for a long time. What's happened, in my opinion, over the last 30, 40 years is we've changed how we understand the role of government. And we've seen a lot of ineffective governing, perhaps, but we've also, I believe, gotten away from our duty to help one another in some ways. And so if you look at the way that revenue has been generated in this country, the tax code, even both sides, you know, in weak moments, Democrats and Republicans both admit that the tax code needs to be revised because there's too many loopholes that normally benefit the people who make the most money. I mean, when you look at huge corporations like General Electric, who paid no taxes in 2011. And you look at guys in this room who certainly paid their taxes, who weren't making anything like, you know, there's a fairness issue. Mm-hmm. And so when I look at how our government paid off our debts in the past, when we needed money in the Depression and to fight World War II, you know, we made money. We had deficit spending meant to support the war effort and meant to pull us out of the Depression. And President Eisenhower in the 50s raised the marginal tax rates for the wealthiest Americans to 75% and at one point to 91% to pay off that debt, because we are all responsible for that debt, for that investment in one another. And, you know, when you see, you know, one party in particular, but members of both parties thinking that top tax rates shouldn't be more than 30%, that's really not – it's not intelligent, because if you look – it needs to be much more nimble. In times of need, we need to spend a little more money and invest. And in times of boom, we need to pay off what we spent in the time of need that just preceded us. Sure. So what's happened in Europe is Germany said austerity, austerity, austerity. And Germany now has, even though their manufacturing is doing okay, it has highest unemployment that it's had for a long time. Their economy has stagnated. And the country, but if you look at the United States, where we had some stimulus, moderate stimulus, if you've asked most economists.
Just real quick, can you explain austerity for the people who don't understand what that is?
Right. Austerity means cutting as much government spending as possible and not investing in the public sector. And it means, you know, cutting retiree benefits, and it means cutting health care benefits, and it means cutting. And that sounds good because we're in an economic downturn. But what we see in Germany and what we're seeing in the United States is most of the unemployment has come from layoffs in the public sector. So when you're trying to get the economy back to 3 or 4% growth, putting people out of work is not a good idea, because we find that consumers, when you put money in their pocket, they spend it. And so what's interesting to me is that austerity has worked to keep their deficit from going up at first, but now the German deficit is going up and their unemployment is at record levels.
CNN just reported that for the first quarter of this year, since January through April, that job increases by major job suppliers, corporate, you know, the people that are tracked, the national, I guess, hiring companies have hired less people in the last quarter than in April than what they did in January. Mm-hmm. But the New York Times was reporting that unemployment was down because it's either people are getting hired somewhere, which would be reported in the news, or that the people have just given up going and looking for unemployment opportunities or benefits or that kind of stuff. If they've walked away from that resource, where are they at? Are they at some kind of new trend that's not being tracked by these institutions? And if that trend is out there, how do we find out what it is? I think it's the trend of the individual, or they're self-employed, they're out there making the buck the best way that they can and going with, you know, who I am, where I am, and how I'm paying my bills, as opposed to looking to some employer helping me pay my bills. So where are they at? And with the austerity thing that you're talking about, it's really inviting people to walk away from the systems that used to be very supportive and to a new system. But how our show is about how we're on Main Street now, making a difference as an individual, as opposed to being a part of a group, that austerity thing.
But we're still a community. We're still part of a community, though. So we also can't make the illusion that we aren't and don't need each other. You know. So it's being a strong individual within the idea of a helpful community is the way I see it. Yeah.
Well, yeah. So I want to help us bring this home. I know you guys got more of a show to do, and I appreciate all the time to hang out and here in Cafe Fairfax with the beautiful butterscotch walls. It's so complex. Obviously, there's going to be new paradigms emerging. You know, and obviously, you know, there may be some ways of doing the economy and doing government that won't be sustainable into the future. But I think the short-term evidence since the crisis shows that the austerity increased unemployment and stagnated the economy, and at least moderate stimulus gave us just a little bit more than 2% growth since 2009. So obviously there is some understanding that the public sector has a role to play, maybe not as big a role to play that we played in the recession, maybe not at other times. But however, I think there needs to be an understanding that what we all can contribute back is something that can help everybody in the long run. Because if one of the reasons that people are saying, or the economists that I've been reading, like Krugman and others, say that the private hiring seems to be lagging a little bit, is because there's not as much demand because of a lot of state and local workers government workers have been laid off. Mm-hmm. And so any time that this consumer economy doesn't have people working, it's going to continue to drag. And I think the other piece that you mentioned, I think there is greater opportunity that's going to emerge for individuals to be self-employed over time. And what that looks like, I don't know. I'm not really an economist, but I think the basic understanding is when times are tough, you need more investment, not less, because people are starving and they're losing their homes. And especially when this particular wave of economic crisis was created by rampant deficit spending, two wars that were not funded, not regulating the markets, and allowing things like these predatory lenders to operate.
Madoff.
I mean, you have all these different folks who were just allowed to just, we're going to make as much money as possible, and wink, wink, everything's okay. People knew the house of cards was crumbling, and they were making sure that those folks were going to be taken care of. Not one CEO has been indicted in this. Think about the savings and loan scandal in the 80s.
Yeah,
thousands of people went to jail. Thousands.
Right.
Not one CEO has been indicted by either the Bush or the Obama administration for this economic crisis, and that might be the biggest untold story.
Hmm.
Anyway, I like holding the scoundrels accountable, but that's not my job either, except to ask folks out there in the world who may have that power to do it for me. But thank you guys so much. It's always a great hangout in the studio with you guys.
All right. Thank you very much, Reverend Scott.
Thank you, sir.
And
it's good having you.
One charitable group is where we started. It tailed off a bit, but that's okay because they're all connected. That will be a guest, future guest here on Main Street Universe, is a lady who represents a group called CatsRule.org, which is a cat rescue, which, of course, will save us all.
Yeah, the meows. I ask my cat when he wants to eat, and he always says, no, I want to eat now. Okay. But it's great that she's a cat rescue and that she...
Cool. And I think Melissa had a comment. I didn't know if you had this comment for Reverend Scott. He's still here for a few seconds. If not, that's fine. But go ahead, Melissa.
It was a general comment about the many traditions in varying religions on hospitality and on the on charity as a form of religious devotion.
Mm-hmm.
For example, of course, there's the Christian doctrine. One of Christ's last instructions to his followers was, if you love me, feed my sheep.
Yep.
Look after other people. Later, I was going before that, the ancient Greek practices of philoxenia, which is basically the hospitality for strangers, and its sort of counterpart, which was hospitality for strangers because they may be gods in disguise.
Mm-hmm.
So you treat your guests and you treat others as you would treat your gods when they were in your presence.
That's right. That's right. The story from Acts, when on the road to Emmaus, if you may remember that, it's after Jesus has been crucified, and there's these two strangers walking, and these two friends walking, and a stranger comes up to them, and they say, no, please come with us, and they invite him to dinner, and he says, oh no, and they say, no, we insist, because their culture was radical hospitality, and they don't know this the whole time, but it's actually Jesus who's walking with them, and so if there is no other rule that's repeated more in the Judeo-Christian Muslim tradition than to take care of the poor, the widow, and the orphan. And I get so irritated when I hear religious leaders trying to talk about decimating public support for those who are needy, because And they get up and they're saying it from a religious perspective. And I'm thinking, look, I study your book all the time, and it tells me that's part of your duty. You know, zakat is the term for it in Islam. And,
right.
And you're supposed to give, you know, a lot. You're supposed to give 10%, you know, to, and, you know,
right.
off the top. Before
in Islam,
the
it's one of their pillars.
That's
one
right.
Of the, one of the other things.
Go ahead, Melissa.
One of the misconceptions about the destructions of Sodom and Gomorrah, the modern conception, misconception is it was destroyed for the act of sodomy, of course. But actually, biblically, in all of the references to Sodom and Gomorrah, the thing that they were most judged for when they're talked about is their inhospitable treatment of strangers.
Mm-hmm.
And in that story, I think it's to a group of angels, comes to the house of Lot. Lot is a relative of Abraham's who lives in Sodom. And he basically, the people of the town want to set upon them very violently and do all kinds of unpleasant things to them. But Lot and his family are kind of spared because they chose to protect these strangers instead of throwing them on the mercy of the people of the town. And that is very often what is cited as the reason why this town, the two towns of Sodom and Gomorrah were destroyed, because they were inhospitable to strangers and cruel to the poor.
Yes, that's a very good point. And sometimes these points of compassion are forgotten in the fiery rhetoric that some evangelical folks engage in. And my brother has just officially left the building, and I thank him for joining us today. And I would like to get to our plugs briefly, and then we will start with our show. This other topic, our second topic of the day. We'll start off with my illustrious co-host, Mr. Kevin Baird. You can be reached at www.templeofgaia.com. He's also a member of a group called Artisans United, and they're having their spring art show on Hummer Road in Annandale.
Yes.
And part of his artwork to be displayed will be Paranormal Windows in Gaia Gardens. He'll be publishing his Horizon Oracle workbook, the Oracle deck he created, his workbook guidebook for it, this month, right, in
yeah.
May?
Yep, that's right.
I'd also like to send a shout out to Zohara Hieronymus, www.zoharaonline.com. And she published a book called Sanctuary of the Divine Presence. And she has helped us out by linking us to her page. And it's www.zoharaonline.com. So feel free to check that out. And if you have a few extra bucks, go ahead and buy her book, Sanctuary of the Divine Presence. Also, Sticks and Stones in Fairfax, Virginia, is a place where you can get a reading from Kevin in person. We were all sort of hanging out there for a little while yesterday. I'd also like to send a plug for Lily at Esoterica, www.esotericanova.com in Sterling, Virginia, 703-777-4642. Still with our New Age interfaith focus, herbs, crystals, stones, oils, candles, incense, divination tools, and more, it's www.esotericanova.com. Okay.
We have Grace Orphanage, who is in the room, and she says, they are from India.
Oh, well, welcome, Grace Orphanage. I think I've seen that icon here before. And of course, we were talking about charity. Mark Kiamba came to visit us from Africa. As you know, my brother being a Unitarian minister, we get interesting visitors here sometimes. And he was in this studio, and he saw this purple bass guitar of mine. And he's like, can I have that for his orphanage in Africa? And anyway, so I said, sure, it was a low-end base that didn't cost very much. So somewhere my old base is in an orphanage across the world, being hopefully being played and being used. And Mark Kiambo was on the run for, he was a supporter of marriage equality and gay marriage, and he got a lot of heat in his home country, so he had to come to the States for a while, and he was speaking and touring the country doing some lectures and such. So it's always interesting to meet some of these people that my brother comes across and his wife in their work, living here with two Unitarian ministers. But we will get on to today's topic, which has a lot to do with the nature of reality itself. When we as humans are born, we are conditioned to accept certain physical absolutes. We are trained by those around us to view the world as a solid physical place. We have our five major senses, and they are the windows from which we observe reality. And it's a natural conclusion. We see, hear, touch, taste, smell, and that is our world. What else is there? Well, it should be remembered that it is the job of scientists to ask questions. Some say the definition of science is an organized method of solving a problem. The scientific method, as it is referred to, looks something like this: observe, hypothesize, use the hypothesis to make a prediction, experiment to test the prediction, repeat steps 3 and 4 until you've removed discrepancies between observation and hypothesis and experimentation. Now, when this is done, we have a theory. A theory can be a pretty powerful thing. People speak of the theory of evolution, and yes, evolution as creation theory is, well, just that, a theory. However, clearly, animals and humans do evolve, or in the case of humans, hopefully we evolve, haha. We have, as part of our survival mechanism, an ability to, over time, adapt physically to the environment around us, as do the animals. But what about beyond physical evolution? What does the world of science have to say about our role as participators in the evolutionary process? What part do we play in our own evolution as a species? And what part do we play in manifesting our own realities here on planet Earth, if any? Right here on Main Street, if you will. Is evolution only the slow process of physical adaptation to an environmental condition, or do we have a part to play in our own evolutions and, of course, our own destinies? Let us explore one aspect of our experience in this world, and that is the act of seeing. The act of seeing is a progressive realization. When one looks at an object, rays of light or photons enter the eye through the lens. Then these photons are refracted and focused onto a retina at the back of the eye. The phase of velocity of the photons is changed. However, the frequency remains constant. Sorry, something in my throat. Upon reaching the retina, the rays of light are then converted to electrical real energy signals. Then they are transmitted by neurons all the way to the back of the brain. In this process of electrical signal conversion, our visual reality is formed. The same is true of all of our sensory realities. In short, electrical impulses going from either if you touch something from the tips of your fingers or from the back of your eye, or into your ears. Your brain doesn't actually see light. Your brain doesn't actually touch anything out here in the world physically. What you are seeing around you are interpretations of electrical signals sent to the brain by our sensory systems. So think about it. our everyday physical reality is but an interpretation of electrical impulses. One great example is when someone goes deaf. Many people who once had hearing and then lost it have what are called audio hallucinations. One story I remember is a man who kept thinking he heard a train coming through his house. Another woman claimed she was always hearing a beautiful symphony playing, the most amazing music. Because the brain still had within it the memory of electrical impulses like that, so it was able to recreate them, and they were incredibly real. These people were actually hearing these things, just not with their ears. So our senses are bringing to us interpretations of light, shadow, and vibrational frequencies. These interpretations, again, as I said, are little more than the code language deciphered and decoded from electrical impulses. So, creation and energy flow is what this universe thrives on. So where does this energy or these signals, where do they originate? Who or what is sending them? Physical matter is always moving. Electrons themselves live in relationship to other elementary particles. They are not just one solid thing. These elementary particles, they need each other, and together they move and vibrate to form us. All matter exists not as a solid, lonely rock or a solid, lonely body, but in order to exist, all matter needs other matter or other electrons. They live within a relationship of each other. This bit of modern quantum mechanical science plays right into the religious philosophies, I think, of most of the hosts of this show, at least, perhaps. We have a part to play in this, and we all need each other. And what is our part as creators? Here is the issue. Can we send the signals capable of altering the realities we find ourselves in? Some would call this magic, prayer, law of attraction, law of similars, law of opulence. I remember one quote, and I think I've used it before, by Wallace D. Wattles, an independent spiritual thinker in the late 1800s, early 1900s. He discusses the illusion of not having enough for everyone. So he discusses how people perceive that there's not enough things to go around and how that helps to form their reality and how we view each other. And as he wrote it, at the time, he mentioned food, clothing, and shelter. He said, it is in fact capable of mathematical demonstration that the single state of Texas, if all of its resources were organized for the production of food, would produce enough to feed the whole present population of the world and feed them well. Now keep in mind, Mr. Wattles does take a quantum mechanical law of attraction approach to becoming abundant in all aspects of life. It's not purely scientific, some would say, of course. I mean, and in his case, he wasn't just viewing it scientifically either. He actually was a deeply religious person and considered himself to be a devout Christian till the day he died. And he also stressed the importance of thankfulness and humbleness, as well as a sense of wanting to serve others. So our big question for today being, since reality itself, the very thing I'm looking at right now, the birds I'm hearing singing outside, our door to the studio is open, all of these things are little more than interpretations, or to me they are little more than interpretations of electrical impulses being sent to the back of the brain. So that's how I'm hearing, how I'm seeing, how I'm touching this music stand here that's in front of me. And since it is a mere interpretation of an electrical signal, are we more than just receivers? Are we also transmitters, is the big question. Do we have a part in this process of sending our own electrical signals out? As they say, a thought is a unit of measurable energy. Do we play a part? Kevin?
I see when we think and we work with our moods internally that it's like a communication between cells, you know, where you have this, like if you look at two cells that bump into each other, like a cell and then maybe a germ or a virus or something. These are all different types of cells, and they're communicating in their own way, and that it's likely that we had a consciousness at that level some billion zillion years ago during evolution, and now we're in a place to where we can see and that we can hear and that we can smell and everything, and it goes a little further. But going back to what you're saying about how what we see goes to the back part of our brains and the back part of our head, if you look at the head, it is a curvature in itself, sort of like the cell in itself, and that it has a center, and that the eye has a back curvature part too. So like the eye is like the first receptor that is a curvature like a bowl, and then the back of the mind or the brain is like a second curvature. What I'm saying is like the cell evolution or the framework is still with us today because for some reason it was helpful. So I see what you're saying with the...
Even in physical form.
Yes.
And Melissa?
When I think of this, I think of a very simple example that I used to use to explain energy work to people. And that is the sort of emotional interaction between two people. At its simplest, basically, if you've ever, I think everybody has known a person who, by just being around that person, this person is a very bright, very happy, very sunny person. You walk into a room and spend 5 minutes with this person, and you find yourself inexplicably feeling better. And, of course, there is the inverse. You spend time with a person who is just an absolute miserable human being. Nothing ever goes right for this person. And spending 5 minutes in the room with this person is enough to put a dark cloud over your own day. And this is a phenomenon that psychologists have studied, the fact that if you're around certain people, emotions seem to be contagious. Someone in a bad mood can put you in a bad mood. And I think this is a very basic example of one person's energies, if you will, affecting another person.
Mm-hmm. And what about the science of magic? I remember a book, Isaac Bonowitz's Real Energy. And could you go into that a little bit?
That book is a very interesting book in that they actually, Isaac and Phaedra Bonowitz, the two authors, employed physics police. And basically these were two actual physicists who they had met through some of the metaphysical forums that they had gone to in the early days of the Internet and started discussing with. And basically they went through your entire vocabulary of physics and science and your entire vocabulary of sort of magic and energy work, and began to discuss these vocabularies in terms of each other, begin to discuss the idea, as Kevin was talking about, of how exactly energy works. Is magical energy the same as the energy of light?
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of thing. And sort of talking about the similarities and... talking about the differences between the vocabularies and what certain things truly meant. Very much exploring the idea of as above, so below, the idea that everything in the universe is sort of a microcosm for everything else in the universe, and when that model works, when it doesn't. One of my favorite examples that was actually in a conversation, I was lucky enough to spend some time with Phaedra Bonowitz this fall, a conversation we had with her and another friend of mine. This friend claims to have only read about 2 books on magic and metaphysics in her life, but is probably one of the most brilliant practitioners I know. Most of what she does, she has figured out by instinct. And she was talking about the idea that everything in the universe on a magical level is either trying to gain energy or lose energy. It's either trying to get, and that we're, I'm sitting there with Phaedra, and I'm just like, you know, that's kind of how things work on a molecular level. Everything on a molecular level, all of the ions, molecules that are ions are either positively or negatively charged, and they are the way that certain molecular bonds work. They're looking to either gain energy and electrons by partnering up with a molecule that has the amount of electrons they need, or mm-hmm. lose them by giving them to another molecule. And we were just sort of had this really interesting conversation about how this conclusion of this person who had a very unacademic approach to magic had come to was very much the same as how physicists approached things on a molecular level.
Mm-hmm. So it's either a sender, a transmitter. It's sort of a constant flow, a constant in and
yeah.
out. And Brett,
exactly.
Are you there?
I'm here.
Just wondering if you...
Yep, I'm here. One of the things I really like that book is actually in the very beginning of the book when he goes in to look at how the various religions of the world view these sources of energy. For example, Christianity and some forms of Buddhist thought take on a very dualistic value. It's either good or it's bad. But how it, you know, how it interacts is where it differs. Some say you kind of need to give and take with all of them, while, for example, Christianity, it's cut, defined, black and white. And then paganism kind of goes a third route, where it kind of just takes a little bit from kind of every school of thought and brings in more information, takes out, you know, more information, and doesn't really look at it in a very clear black and white distinction.
Mm-hmm.
And how the energy works is mainly how you apply it is one of the big things at the very beginning that he goes into. And as you said, he does go into great detail to describe what exactly are these people under specific labels, what kind of things are they actually doing with said energy.
Yes. The idea of intention comes back. I actually haven't read this book, but it was brought to my attention, and it sounds like a great book. There's another one called Holographic Universe that's, I think, really good and goes into some great quantum mechanical stuff. Melissa?
Mm-hmm.
During the... Sorry. When I first started the show, I had a really bad Melissa habit of and I think Kevin gave you a little clue in there, and now I'm doing it, of course, again. But it happens. We're all trial by fire here still, but it's getting smoother. Anyway, back to that book. Your friend, as well, you mentioned, I know somebody like that that's very eclectic and very natural and very instinctive. Does the two physicists mentioned, do they come at the end of the book to a real positive conclusion as to, oh, yes, magic is in fact real? And that's what I meant to originally ask.
I'd like to hear about the vocabulary that you were talking about, too.
Go ahead.
The conclusion that they actually seem to come to at the end of the book is that while there are similarities, science cannot adequately explain magic. And while the experimentation does not seem to show how it works, it seems to show that it does work. It's very similar to, this is not something in the book, but this is the best thing I can come up as an analogy for it. It's a very pragmatic approach. There was an approach back in the world of philosophy and physics about 100 or so years ago at the discovery of the electron, that all basically everything is in a state of flux. Because everything is constantly losing electrons, constantly losing energy, the table you are looking at 1 second is not the same exact color on a quantum level that it was 10 minutes ago. you could not observe it. It's not 100% certain. There's no way, basically, to get accurate measurements of everything. Everything is constantly in a state of flux. And this put everybody in the physics and science world in a tizzy. If there's no possible way to be certain of anything, then why do we have a job? And all of the American physicists sat down, and philosophers instead sat down. It's like, okay, well, do the observations you make work? Well, yes. Okay, well, if it works, then why are you freaking out? Basically, the idea that even if the systems that we see and use are not perfect, if our observations aren't perfect on a quantum level, they still are good enough for us to work with. And that's basically what the book argues, that yes, this, you know, there is a certain amount of fuzzy, and the book is very good at calling out fuzzy science. It talks a lot about vibrations and working with crystals and how much of that is sort of fuzzy science and pseudoscience. And it's like, well, okay. So at the end of the day, we cannot scientifically prove that magic exists. We can kind of explain it and create metaphors for it. We can prove it works. We cannot prove it exists. And that's sort of the conclusion the book came to. Or we can prove it works, we can't prove how it works.
Okay.
If that whole roundabout explanation explained anything, I would be very happy.
Like electricity, nobody can explain,
yeah,
how it works. They just know how to use it.
Yeah. Can I explain to you how my TV turns on? No. Can I turn on my TV? Yes.
Good analogy.
And it sort of explains the laws to use for working with these systems, the practical side of it. The law of attraction, it does go into a great deal on that. And basically, the book is a practical guide. This is, all right, we have all of these people coming up with pseudoscience explanations for things. We're going to confront it with the actual science. But at the end of the day, even if the pseudoscience and the actual science don't match up, we can tell that there is a cause and an effect. And it basically breaks down causes and effects into a system you can work with.
Okay, that's interesting. And a very good point. And I do understand it. There's a lot of things in our lives that we turn on. Our computers could be an example here, where we know how to use them, but how many people really know what's going on inside of that machine? What's happening to make it work? And I'm going to take this opportunity, everyone, to go to our Eye in the Sky report with Mr. Brett Hillman, and we'll get back to our topic after that. Are you there, Brett?
Greetings, everyone. Today the big news is two planets moved yesterday. The moon, of course, moves pretty much every couple of days, and it has moved into Capricorn, which makes it a little bit so your emotions might be a little more grounded, especially in areas of financial thought, is really a big where Capricorn kind of sits, which is interesting because Mercury moves into Taurus, and that actually can kind of do one of the same things. Its main idea is trying to stay practical and go, it won't take in new ideas as much. Mercury, of course, dealing with communication, but it tends to be communication of, if I hear the same old, I'll be happy where it comes to Mercury and Taurus. It's not big on accepting new ideas, Taurus being very grounded, very earthy. Jupiter's in Taurus right now, and it will be until the middle of June. Jupiter and Mercury in Taurus together can probably show a fact that greed may be a problem over the next month. Can be a real problem especially with the moon in Capricorn kind of aiding that movement. So be careful of your money situation, but don't be too greedy. Try and be mindful of your money. Maybe now is a good time to write your finances out and really lay out a good budget for the month. And luckily I mentioned Jupiter, because that is our next 101 segment.
Oh.
Jupiter tends to be to talk about your higher goals. It is the higher self in thought. It is the expanse. It is the biggest planet. What Jupiter does really talks about your destiny. Now, does that mean if you completely walk away from it, it's going to happen anyway? Not necessarily. You have energies are at work. You have the ability to say no, yes or no. Jupiter will deal with things that will make possibly your movement in the cosmos easier by the things that you do. For example, someone born currently with the Jupiter in Taurus, later on in life, we might end up with a lot with another realm of very greedy money makers, which is a problem. I'm having a feeling a lot of our current CEOs were probably born under Jupiter and Taurus. Of course, I can't confirm that with any real validity.
That would be interesting research into that.
But we could see possibly in 30 years from now, we might see the results of this. Because
another
it usually
recession.
Stays assigned for a year or so. So every 12 years, we have another slew of people here. So, and that is my report, unless you have any questions.
I do have one question, but you still get your little symbol here at the end. My question being, you mentioned the moon in Capricorn. This will be brief. You're saying it means to guard. I know Capricorn is Earth, and I'm on the cusp of Capricorn.
Yeah, I would say guard your finances, but don't be try your best not to be that stand up on a fortress and attack everybody else. That can possibly happen at this time. Really no nonsense. Like I said, this is a good time to set up a real sound business plan.
Okay. I was curious if it could also mean, since Capricorn is Earth and Earth is sometimes associated with money, if it could also mean that things might go well for you economically, like maybe a little extra.
I did mention that. I'm just saying be careful not to let it go to your head.
Okay, I got you. Okay.
Because, you know, you're doing well, you're going to get to that point where it's like, ooh, this is going well. I need to make more. And then, of course, when later on, say, Virgo comes around, it'll grab you and pull you right back down, another Earth sign. So just be careful, as always. The stars have energies at work. I do not believe you are a slave to their fixed positions.
Sure. There's an energy direction, you know, that sort of like working with a moon phase. Like, I still think people can do, you know, manifestation without it being, you know, the big waxing moon. But those things will help, and it's a tendency that can help you if you wait for the energy of the universe or the stars or of the moon to kind of be swaying in that direction, perhaps, is a way to look at it.
Yeah, if you can wait, go ahead and do so. The biggest thing to remember, when is the best time to do a spell? When you need it.
When you can work up
if I just missed it, sometimes you can't just wait 27 more days to cast a spell. I mean,
yeah, exactly. That was kind of my point. Plus, you can do it more than once, and you can keep your visualizations with you.
Yes.
The clear visualization means a lot, which will take us back to our topic, is, as you and I and Kevin and Melissa were discussing, the idea that the light that comes to us from the outside world is real, but so is the light that you imagine, because they're both just energy impulses. So the light you imagine when you visualize something really strong is every bit as energetic and real as this light that's coming to us right now. So your visualizations are a real unit of energy. That's why it's so important. The successes I've ever had have always been, when it comes down to it, nuts and bolts, well, A, proper practices in my own life, and if I was doing that, and a really strong, easy-to-grasp visualization, like something where I'm not questioning it at all, just something where it's just a great, crystal-clear visual that I can have in my mind like a movie screen and really not question it at all. Some things are tougher, I think, to try to visualize, and others, depending on the individual, I think. And, for instance, my success a while back with the car. A car was really easy to visualize for me. Whereas something you might want as a quality or something different, may be tougher to get exactly the sort of visualization that you want. But the light, my point being, is the light you think about, the light you imagine, is just as real, just as much an energy force as the light that's coming into your eyes from the outside. Thus the importance of a good, solid, clear visualization, which is just good to, as a practice, just in your life, even if you're not talking about magic at all. Just for, you know, good goal setting, right? Just to have that really clear, you know, this is the next step, this is what I want to do. Even from an atheistic perspective, it's good to be able to do a great, clear visualization of what you really want. Kevin, do you have a segment?
I do.
Okay, Kevin will be discussing one of his Horizon Oracle cards.
Yeah, I was going to go through a few of them. I like to use the time to time too, just because it sets the harmony and gives a harmonic to the conversation as well. But my first card that I'd like to talk about is the networking card. It's associated with the time 7:59, and it talks about us working to make connections with the resources that are around us. So it helps the people that are around us and also helps us at the same time. And the next card is the 1128 card. It's the drive card, and it shows somebody helping transport other people on basically like a wagon or something to a new destination. This all working together as a group is helpful because it helps people see things they would not have seen if had they not been associated with the person that is driving the van or the trailer or the hayride or something like that. And that you guys can go out to my website, which is templeofgaia.com, and click on the Horizon Oracle link, and that will get you to images and descriptions of all the cards that I have that are out there, so you can understand or get to the gist of what the cards and what they have to say and how they're drawn and their themes and everything. And the next card, and the last one, is the empty card, and it's associated with the time 7:41, and it shows somebody holding a can of something, whether it's beer, water, wine, or oil, and showing that they are using this can to the last drop. And now that this thing is exhausted, their task or their duty is done. Do they think about going on and doing something else? Or do they just look at the last drop, go away, and that maybe it would just freeze for eternity and that they wouldn't have to do anything further from that point? This card is really an invitation to say, okay, what we've been doing in relation to, let's say, Economy 2.0 Service Pack 20 is that now it's time to do an upgrade or go with a new app or something that can get us to a better place than where we are today. It's time to upgrade. That's all I have.
Okay. And are you going to maybe at some point put up, not right now, but some maybe on our Main Street Universe conversation page on Facebook, maybe put up images of those cards that you discussed today?
I've been thinking about that, but I was also going to post them on our marquee. And
then, okay, that's fine.
Yeah,
either way.
Put them there, just the time.
Because you were doing that before for a while, that's fine. And back to our point about how our senses think things are real, I work with a woman who's most likely going to be a guest. She's still working it out, schedule-wise and all of that. I won't say
her
name. I don't want to say it yet until I have her permission. But we've discussed it, and she is missing an arm, and she feels her lost arm. And she hasn't had this arm for a pretty long time, but it was lost in a boating accident. And she feels it. It hurts. It hurts her sometimes at work. So her mind still sometimes thinks that that arm is there, and that it's very real, and she tries to pick things up with it occasionally, even though she's been very adapted at, you know, using it at work or just her one arm. But she does occasionally turn around like she's about to swipe something up with the other one, and her mind still thinks that that arm is there, and it sometimes actually hurts and is in physical pain.
Don Juan Mathis talks about that in the Carlos Castaneda books and series about the energy body, and I think that's what that's about. It's known as the phantom limb syndrome.
Yes, Marcy's mentioning something about how she has felt ghost pain here as well. And yes, this woman, she definitely, it was a boating accident, and she has this, what they call ghost pain, and it's real. It hurts her. You can see it bothering her, and she'll go take an ibuprofen, and it's just, it's an interesting thing to behold, as well as I mentioned before, the audio hallucinations. You know, especially this is true for people, I don't know, because if it's for people always been deaf, but for people that once had hearing, they just still hear things. They're not hearing what you and I hear, but their mind is still sending signals like it's hearing stuff. We said the one case was a guy thought a train was coming through his living room. He kept looking around to get out of the way. Or the one woman said the symphony orchestra was playing, and she thought it was... This woman, I think, ended up getting her hearing back, and she said, well, the music in my head was prettier than anything I've heard in out in real life. They were sharper and better. And
well, Beethoven was deaf, and he was a composer.
Yeah, exactly, because the mind knows what these things are, and we've been around for a long time as human beings. And there's a memory, perhaps, even, right, an energy memory. So even someone born deaf or blind may, I don't know because I'm not in that position, I don't know if they see things inside their head. I'm guessing they do, but that would be an interesting thing to bring on somebody that has. I do know some blind people, including Rafe Tesar, the piano player. But he has at one point seen in his life, though, but he went blind at a very young age. And he's an amazing adept
I wonder what
around.
Kind of music Stephen Hawking would compose if he had the chance to compose music. He's the famous
physicist. Oh, okay. Yeah, I know what you're talking
astrophysicist.
About.
Who's recently come on to the culture saying to not trust extraterrestrials because they might be hurtful more than helpful.
Huh. I didn't know he believed in that sort of thing. Melissa, you want to say something?
No, I was just saying that was very interesting about Stephen Hawking.
Oh.
So I had never heard that either, and I'm a very big fan of his.
Oh.
I am the kind of person who is the fan of physicists. I am that kind of nerd.
I'm sorry, who were you the fan of?
Stephen Hawking.
Oh, yeah. And you have, Melissa, if you want to talk about it for a second, you have a blog called the Nerdy Pagan Blog.
Yes,
like
I do. If you want to put in a plug, it is on Tumblr. The URL is nerdypagan.
Okay.
Nerdypagan.
Go ahead and post that out
on
the Main Street Universe group wall.
I will. It is nerdypagan.tumblr.com. And it is full of memes, pagan humor, fun activities, puzzles, mythology links, art interviews. Tomorrow I will actually be interviewing the author of the webcomic Noland Comics, which is a webcomic that is featured. It is a pagan-centric webcomic that is featured on the Minnesota Pagan News site. So that should be very interesting. There'll be an article about that up in a few days.
So this is a written interview then, a journalist.
Yeah.
Okay.
My preferred medium.
Oh, your preferred medium.
Yes. You can't in a paper.
Oh, you're doing fine. But I had one episode where I cannot go back and listen to it. And Kevin said it to me one time, just like he said to you in the chat room. And, of course, when he first said it, I had, like, acid in my blood. I thought I did a great job. And I'm like, what? F you, you know. And then I go back and listen to it. Oh, my gosh. But it's just space.
Yeah.
Space. And I'm kind of hyper, so it's hard for me. I walk around, I pace around. I'm not even at the computer when I do the show. So it was funny to watch my brother here because he's in the doorway and he's walking around, he's pacing around, he's tapping on a drum. He's. I was like, oh, is that what I look like? I look crazy. We both sort of inherited that walking around and pacing around and a little bit hyper. So for me, that's
something
why I
work on until we get in the studio to where you have to sit
yeah.
with headphones, yeah. microphone.
Get to that later. Baby steps.
Exactly.
So I always tell people, if I can meditate, anybody can meditate. It definitely serves. Go ahead.
It's interesting that you were talking about your most effective ones being spells being the ones that were the strongest visualization for me, I have an opposite problem because I have a learning disability. Meditation and visualization is very difficult for me, so I need a physical aspect. I need something with a very strong association that I could work for, which is why I really like herbs and crystals and things that have correspondences. While the ones I work with might not be the ones in the books, I need something that I can touch, that I can work with in order for my brain to make the connection and to sort of focus my own personal energies rather than using something visual.
I would like to clear up, too, that I was saying that for me, remember, we have other senses. So if you can do exactly what you just said and you can take this physical object and it really puts you into the right feeling state, to me that's the same thing as a good visualization, because the sight aspect is only one of the senses we talked about. So it could be hearing, it could just be feeling, like you just really feel it now. And if you feel it really deeply and really intently, that's the state you want to be in anyway. That's what the visualization is trying to trigger anyway, in part. So I think that that should be just as effective as anything else, Melissa, the way that you're describing it, because if you can get yourself into that feeling state, that's
one of the things that I do sometimes. I've gotten better with the visualizing light and visualizing energy, but if I can visualize the emotions associated with that light, if I'm working with, or the feelings associated with that light, if I'm working with the color of red, you know, I might throw in, you know, strong martial feelings, perhaps an image that is symbolic of that, such as the image of a warrior. That's what I'll focus on while I'm trying to generate this light. Or blue would be calm. You know, green, what does it feel like to be grounded, sitting on the ground, sitting on some moss with the earth?
Mm-hmm.
And that sort of helps me trigger as well.
And that's what all these other extra things are for, the crystals and everything else you mentioned. All of it is basically to get your mind or your spirit in that right place. And, you know, some people are good at seeing things in their mind and visualizing, where some it's more of a feeling. And some, like me, I add audio. I almost always, to help my visualizations, I almost always add, even if it's just in my mind, if it's internal, if I add a song or a note to it, or drums, rhythmic drums, like are, you know, so prevalent in so many of these practices all over time. Sound is huge for me in being a musician, so adding sound, you know, adding drums and all that sort of thing really helps.
I do the same thing, Daniel. It's more, for me, what does it sound like? The light, it's going to sound silly, but, you know, the either the Star Trek, or, you know, it's not exactly that. I use one I actually use, but still, it's that gets the point across better. It's what does the thing sound like?
And you and I are born on the same day. So Brett and I are both January 20th people. And also, even just for a basic, like, say if I'm doing, like, just a basic grounding visualization, it has a sound, the light coming down, even often use the waterfall one, but it has, like, an energy sound to it, almost like Brett was saying, a sci-fi energy sound to it, and tones and notes, and I know we're coming down. Any closing statements, folks? We're coming down to it. Brett?
I think pretty much we covered it really well. Just, you know, whatever works for you is generally the kind of the best way to go about it. It's going to take work no matter what, but if you can make it so it fits into your own dichotomy, that ends up being the best.
All right. Melissa, 60 seconds.
I would have to say, oh, I just ummed again, darn it. I would have to say that the best evidence that you can find for whether or not your magic, your energy work is doing its job is your own gut feelings. What personal changes are you noticing within yourself and the world around you? And the trick is to develop the self-confidence and self-awareness to notice the signs and the evidence when you see it.
Okay. And we are now coming down to about 15 seconds. Thank you, everybody, for joining us. Thank you, Marcy and Reverend Phoenix and all of the regulars in the chat room, Brett, Melissa, Kevin Baird. And remember that the mystery possibilities of the universe are closer to Main Street than you may have ever imagined. And I don't know about you, but I can imagine a lot. Thank you, and blessed be.